Today we have four excellent panelists. The order is totally arbitrary. We will we'll start with Madame Mira Kamdar, who is a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also the author of Planet India, The Turbulent Rise of the Largest Democracy and the Future of Our World, un livre qui a été traduit en une douzaine d'éditions étrangères, so very well-known speaker on this issue. So I'll start with Mira Kamdar, Madame Kamdar.
Thank you very much. I'm really honored to be on this panel with you, Ambassador Chrétien, and the other panelists, and I want to thank the organizers of this conference for flying me here from France to talk to you today. Complexities and contradictions, that could really be the theme of my remarks, which are going to be on India. I don't think there's any democracy in the world that's more complex and more full of contradictions, perhaps, than India's democracy. I'm going to make the point, my main point, is really that India's democracy is at a crossroads. It's in a state of crisis, where it goes from here will partially be determined in the elections, general elections, which will be held next year. I speak about this topic as a citizen of the world's oldest democracy, the United States, as a resident of France, another great democracy which gave the world the idea of human rights and citizens' rights, and as an overseas citizen of India, a country to which I'm tied by blood, despite appearances, my father is from India, and in whose elections I may soon have a right to vote. This is one of the things on the table in India, giving Indian diaspora overseas citizens the right to vote. So we'll see what happens with that. Now, Indian democracy was predicted at the very outset to fail. Many people did not believe that a country with such high rates of illiteracy and such high rates of poverty could possibly pull off a functioning democracy. But it did not fail. And in fact, the idea of India, to allude to the title of Sunil Kilnani's still very pertinent book, as proposed by the country's founding fathers and mothers, which included such giants of moral, political, philosophy, and praxis as Mahatma Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru, and B.R. Ambedkar, inspired the nations of the world emerging into freedom during the period of decolonization following the end of the Second World War. And despite the predictions of its immediate demise, India's democracy plugged ahead through the difficult early decades, and it appeared to have entered, from the point of view of the United States, especially after the end of the Cold War and in the wake of the balance of payments crisis in 1991 that forced the country to take steps to liberalize its economy, to have entered into a new era of freedom, both personal and economic. The West counted on India, and still does to a large extent, as a democracy, as an open society, and as a liberalizing, fast-growing economy, to be rising Asia's antidote to China, the country we just heard so much about in the last session. Now, along with all of this, there has been a lot of changes in India's democracy. One of the most massive changes, I don't have time to go into all of them, but one of the most important changes is what my colleague in France, one of the great India experts in the world, Christophe Jaffrelot, calls the democratization of Indian democracy, in which you have a lot more kinds of people participating in the process of democracy. You have had a multiplication of political parties, so that even though the Congress Party, which was the party of the country's founding and remains the party in power currently at the head of a coalition government, that party now has over nearly 800 other political parties with which it shares the political stage with in India. A lot of lower caste people, people who had been excluded from various regions of India, have found ways to participate in India's democracy. So there is that. But at the same time, in recent years, the idea of India and of India's democracy has taken quite a beating. And its own citizens have risen up, have hit the streets in large numbers to protest corruption. We saw that last year. In fact, we have with us at this conference, I believe she'll be speaking tomorrow, Kiran Bedi, who's involved in the movement, spearheaded by Mr. Hazare, Anna Hazare, against the corruption in India. This year, in the wake of the horrific gang rape in Delhi, where again the world saw India's citizens in the streets, the foreign press has carried accounts and opinions lamenting at the same time attacks in India on freedom of expression, so that the open society for which India has been cherished and vaunted also seems to be under attack, with novelists, journalists, and ordinary citizens who post rather banal remarks on Facebook finding themselves banned, threatened with violence, or arrested, internet sites blocked. This is not the kind of behavior we think of in a democracy, especially one that is thrown up as an alternative to China. There have been articles after article in both the Western and the Indian press lamenting the paralysis of India's democratically elected government, its failure to deliver equal opportunity to the country's citizens, to deliver vital physical and human infrastructure, along with, on the other hand, its failure to deliver the next generation of economic liberalization measures that business has been clamoring for. Now, none of this has happened equally across the country. One of the things that's very important to understand about India is that it's, as we say to European audiences, it's a lot like the EU. You have a lot of different states, they speak different languages, and you have India is not progressing monolithically, you know, moving forward at one constant rate of growth. There's a lot of regional disparity. There are some states that are doing much better than others. There are state governments that are more corrupt than other state governments, that are more functional than other state governments. So it's a very pluralistic situation. In fact, we might talk about plural democracies within India as well as outside of India. And still, you have writers such as Patrick French, a well-known writer on India, who's argued as recently as last year that India's Achilles heel is its democracy. Basharat Peer, the emerging writer from Kashmir, who's now become a regular writer in The New Yorker magazine, said in an essay last year, which was published in Foreign Affairs, the title of the essay was India's Broken Promise, and he listed the long litany of disappointments in India's not so long ago trumpeted potential and asked if India's democracy has devolved into something that we might really call psephocracy, which is a term that's spelled P-S-E-P-H-O-C-R-A-C-E, and it's a term used by social scientist Ashish Nandi to describe a system where elections are held successfully, but that is incapable of dealing much more in terms of what, you know, what we think of democracies delivering to citizens. Time magazine put Manmohan Singh, the Prime Minister of India, on its July 2012 cover last year with the headline, "The Underachiever." So it's all is not rosy in the world's largest democracy. Now, what ails India's democracy can be summarized. It's very complex, and again, I'm just going to give you some points, but it'll be summarized under a few major headings. Corruption, first of all, I already mentioned. You have the Commonwealth Games scandal. You have the 2G cell phone scandal. We're talking about billions of dollars that went into private pockets. The latest news in the Indian press over the course of this week has been that the Prime Minister knew about what was going on, although he hasn't yet been charged with anything. The expectation in general that accession to political office is a really nice way to get rich and to accrue to oneself a lot of personal financial gain. The criminalization of politics, the number of sitting members of parliament in India who are charged with serious crimes, rape, attempted murder, extortion, all kinds of things. In fact, in the wake of the gang rape in Delhi, there were calls for all members of parliament who have standing charges of rape against them to be forced to resign. And we weren't talking about two or three people. We were talking about really quite a few members of India's parliament. The legal system really not delivering. Now, one of the cardinal attributes of a functioning democracy is rule of law. And India has a wonderful legal system. It has lots of very nice laws. It has a whole system of courts. Nearly everyone agrees that all the courts are pretty corrupt right up to the Supreme Court. And if you want to get something done, you want to get it done fast, it has to go straight to the Supreme Court, such as, for example, when at the Jaipur Literary Festival this past January, Ashish Nandi made some remarks about lower castes that were taken to offend some people. He was immediately slapped with lawsuits and charges under one of India's new laws. And it took the intervention by the government because of the international outcry for the Supreme Court to immediately sort of get him, you know, dispensed of these charges. But obviously not all of India's 1.2 billion citizens can have their case fast-tracked to the Supreme Court. Nepotism. 100% of the members of India's parliament under the age of 30 are the children of politicians. 80% of the Congress Party members under the age of 40 are the children of politicians. Forget the Nehru-Gandhi dynasty, which many of you, I hope, know about. Indian politics have itself become dynastic across the board. Political offices in India are family businesses. That's really how they've come to operate. Crony capitalism, aside from nepotism, the Asian Development Bank has warned that India has a too cozy relationship between its major corporations, family-run business houses in the most cases, and political parties and politicians. All too often, the government at all levels functions best for big business because, of course, the politicians are able to pocket lots of money in the course of doling out gifts of land and power and water and all the rest of it. Now, restrictions on freedom of expression. Salman Rushdie was not able to address the Jaipur Literary Festival because his books are offensive to the country's Muslims, according to some leaders of some groups who make a lot of noise. Ashish Nandi, I just mentioned his case. One of India's finest painters, Makbul Hussain, who had to actually leave the country. He was not safe for him to continue to live in India as a Muslim, and he died recently. Outside of India because he did not feel it was a place where it was any longer safe for him to live. The Section 66A of the 2007 Information Technology Act, which speaks to content on the Internet which could be offensive or injurious to any of India's citizens, is being abused. It's being abused across the board. You have URLs being blocked, not just by the Indian government, but you had a recent case which was quite sensational. A number of magazines that I publish in and friends of mine who are editors of were blocked. The Wall Street Journal in India, one of their URLs was blocked because a gentleman named Anirundam Chaudhary, who runs a management school that's not been certified by India's higher education authorities, deemed that some articles that had been written about his school were injurious to him. And he filed a case in an obscure little court, and immediately all of these sites where all of these articles had been published were blocked. When the Shiv Sena leader, Thackeray, was very ill and his death was imminent, there was a lot of fear in Mumbai, that would trigger some violence in the streets, and a couple of young women, one 20 years old, the other was 19, I think, one made a comment on Facebook like, why should the whole city shut down just for this one guy? And her friend liked it. Within 2 hours, they were arrested. And a mob came and attacked the girl's uncle's business and trashed his eyeglasses business. So these are the kinds of things that are happening in democratic India. Now, large portions of the population in India are regarded as threats to national security. In fact, Manmohan Singh has said that the Maoists in India are the greatest security threat to the country. So the greatest security threat to the country is not from outside the country, but from inside the country. Many of you are familiar with the situation in Kashmir. Fewer of you may be familiar with the situation in India's northeast, which is also dates all the way back to the founding years of the country. The Maoist movement, which is very strong across an area known as the Tribal Belt, where India's tribals live, in an area which was just neglected by the state for many, many years until fabulous troves of extremely valuable minerals necessary for India's accelerated development were discovered, and a lot of mining interests have moved into the area, and it's very complicated. But anyway, be that as may, these people are seen to be enemies of the state, either in terms of very clear kind of security threats. The Maoists aren't particularly nice in the kind of tactics that they use, or because they're threats to India's development. So farmers protesting land confiscation, or fishermen protesting the putting in of major ports, or people in southern India protesting putting in a nuclear plant, or in Maharashtra protesting a nuclear plant. These are seen to be citizens, are seen to be enemies of the state because enemies of India's development trajectory. There's still persistent prejudice and discrimination against social minorities, spectacular levels of violence against women that have been highlighted by recent stories that have been very big in the international press, and on which I commented this morning on Quebecois television, and on which I'll be commenting this evening on Quebecois television, so very current stories. The poor largely shut out of the fruits of economic growth, while the rich grow even with her. Now, this wealth gap problem is a global problem. It's a problem we just heard in China. It's a problem in the United States. It's a problem in Europe. And it's also a big problem in India. So you have 48 Indian billionaires on the Forbes 2012 list, but you still have higher rates of child malnutrition than in sub-Saharan Africa. That's according to UNICEF. And over 400 billion people who live on less than €1 a day. That's about $1.25 Canadian. Now, none of these problems were solved when India's growth was hitting in the 9% range, and its growth has slowed as the global economic crisis has hit. It's going to be lucky to hit about 6% this year. And growth alone is not really either the solution or the threat to any of these problems that I've outlined to India's democracy. Now, in terms of my brief, I'm trying to go really fast because we have so much to talk about, but in terms of my brief for today on how the foreign policies of Western nations, these are my formal marching orders, can have an impact on India's democracy, let me offer the following. First, we have to support India's citizens who are frustrated, who are sometimes angry, and who yet still believe in their country's democracy. I think the fact that India's citizens pour out into the streets and demonstrate is a really healthy sign. It means that they are confident that they can do that and that they can have pressure on the government. And indeed, in the wake of the gang rape, in the wake especially of these protests that many of you may have seen on television or read about, the government did, after a period of hesitation, move. And they set up a special commission, the Verma Commission. Then they have put into place some new laws, and they really tried to respond to it. More heartening than that, even, is the fact that a whole slew of new civil society groups in a country that already boasts a very vibrant civil society landscape have grown up to try to sensitize, especially Indian men, about issues of violence against women and about women's rights. All kinds of groups. It seems like every day another one with another acronym is coming up, and I think that's all a very, very positive sign. We also have to support, though, India's open society aspect, something which it still claims in its soft power mode as being a positive attribute, as being an asset of the country, and as being something which distinguishes it from China. You simply cannot have social media, artists, journalists, novelists censored, shut down either by fear or by formal application of laws or arrested, and continue to claim at some point that you are an open society. So we have to support India's open society. We also have to be careful that no matter what our fears are about a rapidly rising undemocratic China, or no matter how great our desire is to see India, which is an important market for Western corporations and defense industries, to see India as an unblemished democracy, we can't let our real politique or our real economic considerations overwhelm our commitment to nourishing a healthy, inclusive, to quote language from this conference's organizers, democracy in India. And I'd like to give just one very concrete example from right now. And I know I have 2 minutes, so that means now I have 1 minute to finish. And that is, in 2002, there were horrific violence in the state of Gujarat. Much of it was systematically carried out under the watch of the current chief minister of the state, Narendra Modi. Between 1,000 and 2,000 Muslims were slaughtered, often identified by the use of electoral lists, nice use of democracy. The United States and European countries, and I believe Canada also, declined to issue to Mr. Modi over a period of last decade a visa for him to visit these countries where he has been invited and where he has important support bases, especially in the United States and the UK, among his party's overseas affiliates, the overseas friends of BJP. Well, his state has been one of the better performing states in India. It's not the best performing, but one of the better performings. And he's been a very good marketer of his state's economic performance. He holds a conclave every year called Vibrant Gujarat, which the United States Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. India Business Council, and Canada and European groups wholeheartedly participate in because of the perceived lucrativeness of economic opportunity in his state. And recently, the decade-long sort of boycott of Mr. Modi has started to crumble, so that you had the UK right before the elections in the state of Gujarat say they were doing away with their ban on Mr. Modi. And you recently had the European Union announce just last month that the European Union was going to stop its ban on Mr. Modi, and he has even put on his website that he's been invited to address the European Parliament in November. And just to finish, the German ambassador to India, Michael Steiner, as a spokesperson for the EU group, said, quote, "We respect election results in India, and we have full trust in its judicial system." I've just outlined both problems with both of those for you. Mr. Steiner is less in the know about this than I am. "We are now in a new phase. This respect from us is what the people of India expect from us." And I think this is a very problematic statement. It's disingenuous, to say the least. And I think that one of the real reasons for the turnaround on the part of the EU can be summed up in two words, which are part of a very well-known campaign slogan, and that's Das Auto. Audi just opened a big new showroom in Ahmedabad, the major city in Gujarat. So I would say that the theme of this conference is democracy, human rights, and the fragility of freedom. There is a lot on the line in India's in the current crisis in India's democracy. Why should that matter to us? It matters very deeply because 1.2 billion people live there, a number that's soon to rise to 1.6 billion people. It matters also because the idea of India, the idea of a free, democratic, healthy, educated, and more equal society dreamed up by India's founders, however battered, is still alive, and we need to get it off life support. And it matters because citizens of democracies around the world and citizens who don't have the luck to live in democracies but who aspire to enjoy their rights and privileges still look very much to India, especially as China is also on the rise. And if Indian democracy can't pull itself back from the brink, it will be a great tragedy for Indians, of course, but for us all. What's the biggest thing we can do? Put our own houses in order. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this excellent presentation on the state of democracy in India. From our perspective here, I was certainly glad to hear your presentation, because most of the time in Canada, the focus is on China and not India. We don't hear and we don't study India as much as perhaps we should. Thank you very much. We'll go to our second presenter today, our second panelist, Mr. Carl Gershman of the United States of America. Mr. Gershman is the president of the National Endowment for Democracy. He created the Journal of Democracy. Et sans plus tarder, je lui passe la parole. The floor is yours.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. A lot of friends in the audience. I wasn't planning to do this, but let me start with China and India. I happened just to arrive in time to hear my friend Yang Zhang Li's very effective rebuttal of an apology for the Chinese dictatorship before, and now I walk into a discussion of India. China and India, this is a subject that has preoccupied us a great deal at the NED. We had a meeting a year ago. We brought some top thinkers together to sort of look at where the future lies, with China or with India. And I think the general consensus at the meeting was that if you look 30 years out, which of the two countries is more likely to have the same kind of political system that it has now? And there was a general consensus, even among people who share all your criticisms, that India did. Why is that? There's a Chinese, an important Chinese intellectual by the name of Yu Jiangrong, who heads the Institute of Rural Studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, who made a distinction between what he called rigid stability and resilient stability. Rigid stability is, he said, what exists in China. Resilient stability is what exists in India. Rigid stability is when the system regards any protest, whether it has to do with minority rights or land rights or corruption, or workers not getting their pay as a challenge to the basic system. Whereas a resilient stability sees a problem and it then makes adjustments to try to see how it can survive and deal with that problem. When I arrived for the first time in India in 1996, we were thinking of planning a meeting to celebrate 50 years of Indian democracy. And I met with a lot of people there, and obviously the point came up about what we just heard about India's immense pluralism, linguistically, ethnically, religiously. And people said to me, you know, we're not a democracy because you want us to be a democracy. We're a democracy because we have to be a democracy in order to survive. The speaker before said China's a big country. Therefore, it has to be a dictatorship because there's no way to manage a big country. India can only survive with that kind of pluralism because it can deal, because it's resilient and can deal with all these different forces that come together. And I think it's also worth remembering when we think about China and India was that India is where the Dalai Lama is today, that in China there is an effort, what the Dalai Lama says, to commit cultural genocide against the Tibetan people, leave the Uyghurs aside for the moment. Whereas India at least has given refuge and hope to the Tibetan people. If we believe in minority rights, that's actually rather important in thinking about these two countries. The Indian thinker Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate, 1998, you know, said that why do people want democracy? We heard before from the fellow who spoke in defense of the Chinese system, you know, that there. People want different forms of democracy. You know, that there's no any one form. It's not just multi-party democracy. But Amartya Sen said that there are certain purposes that democracy serves and certain reasons why people want democracy. And he said democracy has four fundamental purposes. First, it has a protective purpose. How do you defend human rights if you can't organize, if you don't have the capacity to protect yourself? Sen had said that he's very famous for his thesis that no mass famine of the kind that took place in China in the 1950s, when tens of millions of people died, has ever taken place in a country that is a democracy with a free press, which can expose the crisis. So democracy, and how do you deal with corruption, which is a critical problem for China, if you don't have a free press that can expose corruption, if you don't have an independent judiciary which can try and punish people who are corrupt, if you don't have free elections which can throw out the rascals? How do you deal with the problem of corruption? You can't. It's going to be an endemic problem, which is why in our Journal of Democracy, we just published a series of articles on China called The Tipping Point. Is China approaching a tipping point? And it's interesting that all the scholars who contributed to this felt that indeed China was approaching a tipping point, because there's no way that it can deal with this expanding information, expanding internet, more aware citizenry, and also you know, deal with this corrupt elites. So democracy has this protective function for the people. It also has an instrumental function, because, you know, if you have a democratically elected government, that government has an obligation to the people, to be responsive to the people. If it's, you know, if it's not if government by consent, if you have, you know, a dictatorship, they don't need to be responsive to the population and to deal with their problems. And there are other instrumental purposes democracy serves. Is the argument about the democratic peace, but there are various functions that it serves of that instrumental nature. It also does better in terms of economic development, in terms of studies that have been done of comparative countries. The third reason is that it has a constructive purpose. And Sen talked about the way people in Indian states who have democracy are able to talk among themselves, are able to solve their own problems, are able to grow as people. He said that the issue is not whether a particular people are fit for democracy, whether they have the capacity to be democratic. The issue is, how do people become fit through democracy? How do they grow? How do they learn? How do they take responsibility for solving their own problems? And then, of course, you have the intrinsic meaning of democracy, that it is the only system that exists in the world today, whatever Churchill said, that respects the dignity of the individual. In any event, the theme of this panel, and let me get back to what I was going to say in my original remarks before I got waylaid by the China-India issue, which is a very fascinating issue, is democracy and foreign policy complexities. I think the theme of this panel that you have in your books sort of stated the issue in a very ambivalent way, that somehow the goal, the desire of democratic countries like the United States or Canada to advance democracy is somehow problematic, that somehow it violates the sovereignty of other countries. And I think what's important to state here is that the idea of supporting people who are working for democracy is now part of the international norm, order. It's an accepted norm of international society today. The tendency of some dictatorial governments today to try to block any kind of assistance to people who are working for democracy is itself a violation of those international norms, and there's just been a resolution to this effect introduced by Norway and supported by 62 countries that has just been passed by the UN Human Rights Council. Also, the definition of this panel spoke about contested definitions of democracy, as if there is not a single definition of democracy that is really implicit and contained in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Yagyar Li spoke to earlier, which has to do with government by consent and respect for fundamental rights. Now, there are governments in the world today that call themselves democratic, but they always seem to attach an adjective to democratic. So you have Chinese socialist democracy, and you have Iranian Islamic democracy, and you have Russian managed democracy, and you have Venezuelan Bolivarian democracy. Why do they need these adjectives instead of just democracy? Because obviously they want to appear democratic, and the adjective gives them a way to cloak their authoritarian and dictatorial practices in the rhetoric of democracy. And it shows that democracy is today the only legitimating form of government in the world, and that even dictators have to pay their respects to democracy by calling themselves democratic, but they attach an adjective to it to make themselves, to give it a kind of unique, seemingly unique character, but I wouldn't grant that any credibility. It's not democratic. How much time do I have left?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Let me, in the remaining time that I have, just outline what I think are the major challenges that face democracy today, and what we may be able to do about it and how we should do something about it. There are four basic challenges that we face in trying to work to advance democracy in the world. The first is that there are still some 47 countries in the world, according to the Freedom House survey, that are dictatorships. There are dictatorships of different kinds. Actually, I think of China, I don't know if you'll agree with me, Yang Zhangli, I think of China as somewhat of a relatively open dictatorship. People flee from North Korea to get to China. China is a dictatorship, and the Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo is still in prison. But people in North Korea flee to get into China because North Korea is the most dictatorial. So there are, let's recognize that there are different levels of dictatorship, but still the problem of dictatorship and helping people who are fighting for freedom within dictatorship is one important issue that we face. A second is something I've already referred to, which we call hybrid or semi-authoritarian countries, countries like Russia and Venezuela that pass laws that restrict rights, such as I mentioned that earlier, that groups can't receive funding, for example, or they try to control civil society. And this is the purpose of this resolution that was just adopted at the UN Human Rights Council. And I want to say that Canada has been in the lead in the international community in heading up the defense of civil society against efforts by governments to control civil society. And they had a working group within the community of democracies on the defense of civil society. And this is a very important dimension of our work today, because increasingly authoritarian governments that feel threatened by their people are passing such laws to try to control them. We call that rule by law, not rule of law. Democracy assistance is consistent with rule of law. The passage of laws restricting the ability of groups to take resources is ruled by law, and there are many other ways they do that. A third challenge we face is in the Middle East, where Islamist governments, through democratic processes, have come to power, but do not respect what we consider to be liberal values, whether it's women's rights, freedom of religion, individual rights, freedom of the press, and so forth. And in these countries, the struggle is only beginning. And we want to preserve the opportunity for alternatives to emerge in countries like Egypt and other countries in the Middle East. Tunisia is doing much better. And I think they can, but part of the agenda is not just to keep political space open so that these alternatives can emerge, but also to fight to defend liberal rights and liberal values in these countries where they are under threat. And finally, and the last challenge we face is a lot of the new democracies today are very fragile, they're very institutionally weak, they have difficulty dealing with problems of corruption. Very often in many of these countries, there are high levels of violence, and it's very important to assist these governments in strengthening the infrastructure of democracy so that they can begin to strengthen the rule of law. Just two last points, what can be done and how it should be done. In terms of what can be done, you can provide financial resources, you can provide technical resources and advice to people who are working for democracy. You can promote research on democracy to help us understand better what the problems are. And political solidarity is also extremely important for people who are, especially people who are in the toughest situations fighting for freedom. It's very important to devise various ways of showing solidarity with people. I'm happy to note that we have in the audience today Erwin Kotler, who is a member of the Canadian Parliament and one of the great defenders of human rights in the world today, who really exemplifies what I mean by showing solidarity for people who are fighting for freedom in the world. And finally, a last point, how this work should be done, because I agree that this work can sometimes be done very badly. If it's going to be done well, it has to be done, first of all, in my view, not so much by governments, which have policy objectives, but by independent institutions that can directly support civil society to achieve their own objectives, not the foreign policy objectives of a government. It's best to do this work bottom up as opposed to top down social engineering. It's best to do this work in a manner that respects the indigenous nature of the institutions involved and recognizes that democracy is something that has to come from within and cannot be exported. It has to be done in a way that is discreet and low key, not with a megaphone announcing our great purposes. Because ultimately, the central players in this work for democracy are the indigenous populations that are trying to realize their own vision for a better life, which is obviously very much involves democracy. And why do we do this? We're not telling people what to do. The issue that faces people like ourselves in countries like the United States and Canada and other established democracies is whether we have an obligation to help people who are fighting for democracy and freedom. They are fighting for it. We're not telling them to fight for it. The question is, should we provide assistance? I think we should. I think we should do it without the kind of ambivalence, the diffidence, the lack of self-confidence that I saw in the definition of this panel, and we should do it because it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Notre troisième participante, our third speaker, is Fabienne Hara of France. Madame Hara is the Vice President in charge of multilateral affairs of the International Crisis Group. Her boss, I guess, is Louise Arbour, is a good friend of some of us in this room. Alors, sans plus tarder, Madame Hara, je vous donne la parole.
Thank you very much. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me. I represent the International Crisis Group in New York. I'm the Vice President for Multilateral Affairs, and I particularly interact with the United Nations. I've been doing that for about 5 years. For some of you who you may know that International Crisis Group works on conflict prevention, conflict management, and conflict resolution. and that we cover about 60, 70 different conflict situations. Today, I thought I would talk a little bit about the challenges of building democracies in fragile states. I looked at the way the panel discussion was framed, and I saw a number of keywords: democracy, human rights, responsibility of strong states, impact on sovereignty, contradictions in foreign policy. So I thought that I would talk about the challenges of building democracies in weak states, in fragile states, but also perhaps a little bit about the way I see conflict management evolving, conflict management that is informed by a number of democratic values, by normative values, at the UN especially. But the way it's evolving is slightly worrying. And I want to talk about the use of force in conflict management. And in the second part of my presentation, I'll say a few words about the intervention in Mali and the challenges of the post-intervention by French forces. As I said, many of the tools that are now used by big states, strong states, to manage conflicts in weak states or fragile states are very much informed by Western democratic human rights values, by liberal templates. I'm talking about peacekeeping, peace building, intervention, direct military intervention, institution building, use of international justice instrument or mediation. These are all political interventions in conflict management, part of the toolbox. There are, of course, a number of doctrines that I should also mention, including the doctrine of the responsibility to protect, which came about in 2005 and focuses very much on the responsibility of the state to protect its citizens from genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing, but also the responsibility of the international community to come to the rescue of the weak states if they cannot fulfill their responsibility. But there are a number of contradictions in the way these instruments are applied, a number of double standards that I want to very briefly outline before I go into discussing Mali. One is the fact that, of course, you know, for the UN, for the Security Council, there is now a growing involvement in internal conflicts. If you actually look at the number of Security Council resolutions that are addressed directly to parties to a conflict, the number has grown enormously. The vast majority of these resolutions are focused on Africa and the Middle East. And this is not a negligible fact. In fact, 70% of the agenda now of the Security Council is about Africa. And I'll come back to that later on. It's also a fact that the decisions are made about how to deal with these conflicts by states that are not necessarily democratic. Certainly on the Security Council, the P5, including Russia and China, are not democratic. They have not signed the Rome Treaty of the International Criminal Court. And yet these are the states that refer Libya, Sudan, and so on to the International Criminal Court. These are the states also which decide to use force in certain instances. How do they apply this is a real question to me. And I want to underline a trend that I find slightly concerning, which is the mainstreaming of human rights and protection of civilians and so on into the discourse on intervention, and the fact that it is leading to a militarization of the response to conflict that is not necessarily going to lead to stabilization in a broad sense of the term. If you look at the last few authorizations that the Security Council gave to military intervention, look at Libya, look at Côte d'Ivoire, look at Mali very recently, but look also at the mandates that were given to peacekeeping operations very recently in Darfur or in the Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, you'll see a shift towards a more military or more security-focused approach to these conflicts. If you look at, for example, Libya and Côte d'Ivoire, in the case of Libya, the Council worked at unprecedented speed. They passed two resolutions, the first one, 1970, 11 days after the start of the uprising in Libya, and the second one, 90 days later, 1973, that authorized the NATO intervention. And it was authorized under the mandate of protecting civilians by all necessary means. this intervention in Libya was done under the doctrine of responsibility to protect, with protection of civilians squarely in the mandate of the resolution. The same thing on Côte d'Ivoire, 1975, was authorized also to enforce the results of a presidential election that President Gbagbo at the time didn't want to accept. But the association in these two cases between protection of civilians, responsibility to protect, and regime change, because in both cases it led to, the interventions led to regime change, discredited in a way the doctrine itself. Or at least, at the very least, it divided the Security Council, and the big countries like India, like Brazil, South Africa, but also Germany, abstained from voting this resolution. The division that it led to on the Security Council is very deep, and there's been quite a few issues since then in terms of making decisions, for example, in the case of Syria. Now there's no talk about responsibility to protect in the case of Syria. We talk about the political solution, and yet 70,000 people have died. But if you also look at peacekeeping mandates, there are more and more of what we call stabilization mission. And for example, in Eastern Congo at the moment, there's discussion about intervention brigade against armed groups, whatever they are, Congolese and foreign armed groups. And this is, I think, very problematic, because there are many, many armed groups, some on the Kabila, on the presidential side, on the Congo side, some that are sponsored by the neighbor Rwanda. There are many groups, many militias. Some are politicized, some are not politicized. But overall, there is the belief that the use of force and that protection of civilians will drive the agenda and basically call for more war. I've been following Congo for 20 years, and war calls for war, violence calls for violence. Unfortunately, violence doesn't bring results. What will bring results is a focus on consolidating the state and the institutions of the state and on political solutions at the regional, national, and local level. Now, if you look at the various agendas driving this militarization of the response, there is, and this is what I really wanted to say, there is a human rights agenda, and I think it's very problematic. Protection of civilians, human rights, is now leading to war. And some of the NGOs, some of the civil society colleagues that I work with in New York, are actually very much supportive of that. They find that, and it's, they're right about it, that the systematic rape of women in Eastern Congo and the abuse of human rights of the population of Eastern Congo is so unacceptable that something needs to be done. And that something is, let's send the peacekeepers in, let's protect the civilians by force. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. It hasn't worked. And the question to me of all these approaches is, how do you do the political work? How do you do the peace-building work that's necessary to build institutions of the state instead of going it by force? And one last point about that. It's very interesting to me that the Africans now are pushing for this military agenda. They have become very interventionist themselves. And as I said, 70% of the subjects dealt with by the Security Council are deal with Africa, African conflicts. But in the last couple of years, we've seen a push from the African countries to deal with some issues as counterterrorism. We see this in Somalia, and now we see it in Mali. I mean, there's a big push by a number of West African countries to deploy in Mali at the moment to deal with the jihadis by force. And there's a willingness, I guess, from the number of countries in Africa to have a military solution to this conflict. So the African solution to African problems that we've all been calling for in the last few years might lead to a disagreement or doctrinal tension about what peace and security means between some democratic states and them. Anyway, this is the context in which we are discussing at the moment the operation in Mali or the future peacekeeping operation in Mali. As you know, the French forces intervened in Mali at the beginning of January, and this was to repel an advance by Islamist groups towards Bamako, towards the capital Bamako. These groups occupied northern Mali since the beginning of the year, the last year. 22nd of March, there was a coup in Mali. And they took advantage of the chaos in Bamako to occupy northern Mali. And in the beginning of January, they decided to come down south and to come closer to the capital. But at the same time, while they were doing that, there was a lot of confusion in the capital city, and the French forces stopped the advance of the Islamist force, the Islamist forces, but they didn't yet finish the job, let's say. There are still quite a few concerns security-wise. The French intervention was necessary, we believe in Crisis Group, that it was absolutely necessary, and that it created an opportunity also to build something more sustainable peace in Mali. But there are also a lot of misunderstandings about what can be achieved in a certain time frame. And what can be achieved now is the question that everyone is asking. And we have a few concerns about the way the crisis in Mali is seen. It's seen, as I said earlier, also through a security-first lens, through the lens of the war on terror. And here again, we know, if we actually look at the root causes of the crisis in Mali, that there is going to be a need for a political process. The crisis itself is a crisis of governance. There were many democratic elections in Mali that actually did not go very well. There was quite a bit of fraud in the last few elections, but it was very much overlooked, and a lot of people I know, including myself, were quite surprised to see how deeply corrupt the system was when it crumbled in 2012. It was a big surprise to a number of players to see how empty the state had become. But this is very much a crisis of governance. There is a problem also of the relationship between the state and society, between the state and the citizens. There is no trust by local communities in the state structure. And this is really the work that needs to be done now. So there are a lot of different wars going on at the same time in Mali. There is the French war, and as we know, we have 15 hostages in Mali. There is a war against terror, against jihadi groups, but there is also a war for territorial integrity. There is a war by some of the Tuaregs, I wouldn't say all the Tuaregs, but some of the Tuaregs for independence or for autonomy as well. So there are lots of different wars, but the question that we're asking now is, can this, all these wars be won at the same time? Will the French war be won? Will they find the hostages? Does this mean that Mali will get democracy and will get stability? And this is really the challenge that we are looking at now. Just to finish, the discussion is at the moment at the UN whether or not the UN peacekeeping mission that will follow on the French operation should have a combat role or not. Should it be an extension of the counterterrorism operation that has been underway? And of course, you know, there are a number of people at the UN who believe that this would be very dangerous for the United Nations to play this role, and that it should actually focus on peace building and so on. But in this context, is it possible, in a context that is framed by the war against terror, is it possible for the UN to play the political role that is needed over the long term? Because institution building and national reconciliation will take some time. So my plea, in other words, is let's move away from militarization of response to conflicts and let's focus on political processes and institution building. It's a very simple message. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for reminding us of the importance of Africa. It's not always understood. You mentioned that Africa can get 70% of the attention of the Security Council. Big surprise for me. Also, we do not realize perhaps the extent of the human misery taking place in some parts of Africa. You mentioned the Eastern Congo, the Kivu. We mentioned these days 100,000 deaths in Syria. It's in the millions in Eastern Congo, and very few people are conscious of the of this drama taking place there, and the incapacity of the United Nations with the huge force in Eastern Congo to deal with the problem of security and tremendous problem of rape. Merci beaucoup. We'll go to our last speaker. We have heard excellent presentations about India. I missed the previous discussion on China, but I understand it was a vigorous one, and one that allowed a good understanding of the issues in this part of the world. Now we will hear about another hugely important country, Russia. Russia, you know the relationship that we've had with your country, greatest ally during the last war, the previous century, the Cold War, the main enemy of the West for many, many decades, and suddenly Russia has emerged as a new entity. I don't know how to describe this relationship. Is Russia certainly not an enemy? Is it an adversary? Is it a friend? If I would like to think that Russia is a friend, but a strange friend. So the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. First of all, forgive me, please, for being not a lawyer and not being a representative of any influential international organization which is promoting democracy. I do represent a different side, the side of an object rather than a subject. And Russia is extremely interesting case because it's both success and failure story if to deal with international relations and how they can influence what's going on with regard to democracy in this or that country. According to Freedom House, Russia is not free. That's why it can serve a good example. And I think that Daniel is not here yet. So I feel free to criticize Freedom House then. I do participate in their evaluation exercise. And I would say that, in my view, there are two problems with them with regard to Russia. First of all, their measurement works like a minimal thermometer. You know, it's going down if the situation is worsening, but it never goes up if the situation is improving in this or that sphere. So if it's going up, it's stable. I mean, evaluation of the Freedom House. If it's going down, they're happy to decrease it. And the second very important issue is that in a country like Russia, of this size, you can never understand what's going on with regard to democracy if being focused on the federal level alone without taking into account the regional level. And that's the problem with their rating, although, well, they are doing very, very good job. And I am a geographer by background, and my first point is that you can never learn about Russia if to neglect geographical dimension. So international relations did play and are playing very different role, I mean, in terms of influencing Russia's political, internal political development. And we can differ between three periods, at least, in the 90s, when Russia was very weak and it was weakening. The international players did influence a lot what was going on in the country under Yeltsin. When Putin came to power, at first the country continued to be weak, but the state was strengthening due to huge financial wealth. And at the end, we came to the stage when, like now, Putin just not pay any attention on to what is said by international players, and he almost no more pretends to be a Democrat. And what is good is the fact that Russia is fastly moving in direction to normal authoritarian regime, and it's no more hybrid regime in full sense. So economic crisis played very important role in this sense, making the West A, less focused on the post-Soviet space, and B, less influential. And at the same time, there is political crisis in Russia, which makes foreign policy a kind of a hostage of domestic politics. So if Putin cannot increase his legitimacy by means of elections, then foreign policy is one almost single opportunity for him to increase his legitimacy, and that's why he can be harsh in foreign policy just in order to improve his position in domestic politics. There are three different aspects of international relations influence I'd like to speak about. The first is the result of general international development. When nobody is trying to teach nobody. And it's just due to the general development that it became almost needed to say that you are a democracy and you do have elections. And that's why Putin, for example, did not choose the option to extend his staying in office for the third term, but he switched to the tandem, which played a certain role in promoting expectations, if not promoting democracy in a real sense. It's very important issue. So the second aspect is democratization in result of special efforts from outside. And it can be done with regard to the state when the government is forced to do or not to do some important things. And we can remember Magnitsky's list, which was recently adopted by the United States Congress. Society can be an object as well of democracy promotion. What is important from this point of view is the fact that you should look in wider time-space prospect to understand not only immediate but some side effects of such a direct democracy promotion. Like, say, let's take Ukrainian presidential elections in 2004, which was considered to be a kind of celebration of democracy. In case of Russia, it led to the whole package of anti-democratic reforms, political reforms, which, have been realized in late 2004. And so the effect, I think that the positive effect in case of Ukraine was overweighted by the negative effect in case of all other post-Soviet countries, which became afraid of international involvement and intervention in case of their elections. And the immediate reaction of them was to push out all international organizations. So the formula has been coined that if in the past, revolutions have been caused by social forces, now there are think tanks and NGOs who are playing this role of an agent. That's why Putin did push out USAID and some other international and Western organizations. And this year, it's very important, this year he did increase very essentially the budgetary support to NGOs, which is something like, say, plus 4 billion rubles. But at the same time, the negative effect of international organizations being pushed out from Russia is four times more important in terms of the financial its financial effect. So the third aspect is democracy in result of bottom-up efforts inspired by international relations. And here I can totally agree with you. This is the most important thing, but in my view, we should look for the balance between all three aspects. It's impossible to wait for, very effective work of this bottom-up movement if it's somehow not prepared by international assistance. And it can be easily illustrated by recent Russia's political protests and the increasing role of election observers. There is increasing number of Russians who are eager to observe elections, and leads to more honest reporting about election results from one side. From other side, it leads to larger scale fraud by the state, because if some polling stations are totally controlled by observers, in order to get results needed, you should add ballots or you should increase fraud at those stations where there are no observers, which is playing in favor of democracy as well. My next point is that geopolitics matter. And here I'm more geographer than political scientist. And if to look at Russia, you can see how different the country is with regard to democracy, and border regions, westernmost and easternmost regions of Russia, are those where there is the biggest social protest from one side. From other side, there is biggest share of votes in favor of nationalist political parties. And almost all border regions of Russia can be described as those where nationalistic parties are getting higher percentage of votes. And together with both national capitals, Moscow and St. Petersburg, border regions are playing very important role with regard to social protest. We are calculating ratings of democracy for Russian regions for more than a decade, and it's very interesting to watch and to measure differences in different aspects of democracy with regard to different regions of Russia, and I can say that the difference in general is not decreasing. Although Russia is no more federation, it's more like, say, unitarian state, and differences in political organization between different regions are not that big. Now I am switching to lessons, both positive and negative lessons with regard to democracy promotion in case of Russia. My first point is that it's needed to promote principles, not persons, democracy, but not Democrats. And it's very important if to remember that in 1993, when Yeltsin used tanks against the parliament, the West did support him because Yeltsin was considered to be a Democrat, while the parliament was considered to be old-fashioned and conservative. In 1996, there was Yeltsin's re-election, and Yeltsin did win almost in Hugo Chavez fashion. He got ill, almost dead before the voting. It was not reported by media, which did play very important role in promoting Yeltsin's history. The West that time did support Yeltsin against what was considered to be restoration of communism. Now we know that the second elections in almost all Central European countries were elections when communists could come to power, but these communists could be very different from what they used to be in past. And not only this is important illustration of the fact that, well-established advanced democracies could be not that right with regard to developing democracies, but it's important to understand that Russian citizens lost trust toward international players when being confronted by these double standards. The second principle should be to think globally but to act locally, in terms that it's needed to take into account local conditions and to avoid universal prescriptions, which I think is clearly seen with regard to Middle East. And it's important to consider side effects and consequences not only in this particular place but everywhere else. And I did try to illustrate this point by Ukrainian presidential elections. My third point is to invest into mechanisms rather than into results. And this is exactly the case of election observation. There were almost decade-long training which was financed by international organization, which did not play any important role in, making better Russian elections. But now, last 2 years, it became very important, and if only it would be not prepared, if only it would be no infrastructure and no knowledge about how to observe elections and no trust to observers, then it could not act in the way it did act. The fourth point is to be realist and patient and not to claim for impossible, just to support natural development. This is about the possibility to establish democracy overnight. It's impossible. It's even less so in case of such a huge country with huge inertia like Russia. The fifth point is cost-benefit approach. We should look for not just for democracy at the surface, but for self-sustainable and deeply rooted democracy, and we should calculate what exactly we need to invest in order to get these results. And my sixth point is about objects and subjects. It's needed to understand that in international relations, national governments do behave and should behave in favor of their own nations. We should not wait from the United States government to be very cautious with regard to democracy in Russia just in order to make Russians more happy. So there are national interests, and they should prevail in international relations. That's why I do fully agree that there should be international organizations, first of all, not directly connected to national governments, which should play the major role in promoting democracy, and which should not be seen as, somehow interested in certain results and playing somebody's side. So I did finish with my lessons. And finally, I'll try to answer the question whether Russia can be considered to be success or failure story if to look at 22 years of Russia's independent development. In my view, although the situation in Russia now does not look very nice, it's possible to think that there is, failure is not dominated, and there is success story in general, and it's connected with very different state of public opinion and the very different state of society in Russia, which, regardless of much less democratic than it used to be 10 years ago, political institutions, I think, makes it possible to hope that Russia in a while, perhaps not in a very short while, will join the family of democratic countries. Thank you.
We have about 15 or 20 minutes for questions from the floor, so go ahead. The floor is yours. Please identify yourself and use a microphone, please.
My name is Sam. Is it up? Oh, anyway, my name is Sam Goldberg. I'm a retired historian and alumnus of McGill. This morning, I attended a rather interesting political science lecture, which I think is relevant to our discussion. The speaker divided human rights into two broad categories. He called them de jure, or the ones based on law, like freedom of assembly and freedom of religion, and de facto ones, in other words, human rights in practice, rules to protect against imprisonment and torture. And his argument was that if you emphasize one, particularly the legal one, chances are you're going to violate the second, particularly in fragile states, because it's much easier to arrest and torture people than to stop public speeches. And even in non-sort of fragile states, we have this example as well. Just to use an easy example here in Montreal. Montreal was one of the pioneers in treating mental illness by developing the use of tranquilizers. So the result is that we freed a lot of mental patients, but we never devoted enough time for follow-up. So half the homeless people you see in Montreal are ex-mental patients who are being neglected, because supposedly we did them a favor by freeing them from the institutions, but we never bothered doing the follow-up, which is costly. So my point in all of this is that human rights is not a zero-sum game, the idea that any improvement is better than none. I think if we don't push human rights in an intelligent fashion, then we may make the situation worse rather than better. That's the point that I'm emphasizing, the need of precaution, which is something, the precautionary principle is considered very important in environmental matters now. I suggest it also is important in human rights discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So it was more a comment than a question, so I'll...
We can take a few, maybe.
Would you like to say something?
Yeah, no, we can take a few, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
My name is Michael Leach. I'm an LLM student at McGill's Law Faculty. I had the privilege of being in Kabul for two national elections, presidential and parliamentary, both of which ended up being more or less fiascos, for which most of the blame was given to the Afghans for either corrupting it or the Taliban for tearing it apart. And while I was there, I couldn't help reflecting while, you know, I'd hear things go boom in the city, or while somebody was taking pot shots at the checkpoint around the corner, or while I was getting stories in from the south about ballot stations being attacked, or outrageous ballot stuffing stories that really blew everybody's mind. I mean, how obvious and open they were. I couldn't help reflecting at the time that there was something inherently crazy. I'm not being critical, I'm just saying it's something inherently crazy about introducing a political process to a fragile, conflicted state that institutionalized a periodic process where people competed for political capital in order to, you know, win the keys to the kingdom. So my question is, in those sorts of environments, is there a way to introduce democratic processes to fragile states that does not engender further violence or conflict? Or should we assume that it's kind of like pouring salt into a wound where in the short term, it's going to hurt a lot and might make things seem worse, but in the long run, it'll clean things out and heal things at the end? How should we look at that? Thank you.
Thank you. Some notes because I will call on you. Go ahead.
My name is Jared Genzer. I'm a human rights lawyer in Washington, D.C. I also teach a seminar at Georgetown Law School on the UN Security Council. One of the questions that I ponder and would love to hear the panelists' response to is what needs to be done to create the political will to create an appetite for doing substantially more peacekeeping around the world? And I say that in the context of the fact that right now, there are deployed internationally roughly only about 100,000 peacekeepers. That is a budget annually of about $8 to $9 billion, which, as an American, I tend to think in American military terms, but that's less than 1% of the U.S. military's budget annually. And in a place, as the moderator was saying, Mr. Chrétien was saying, you know, a place like Congo, you have a population of 70 million people and 25,000 peacekeepers on the ground. And so in that context, it's no surprise from where I sit that it's impossible under those circumstances in such a fragile state to have an impact that we would like to be able to have to help restore basic stability, build governmental institutions, create fundamental human rights commitments that can be fulfilled, and ultimately help democratize countries. And so at the end of the day, I would just say I think that these are all fragile democracies, the 16 countries around the world that peacekeepers are present in. And unless we substantially increase our investment to do the multidimensional peacekeeping that's required, there's no real chance that most of these countries have of doing more than just kind of kicking the can down the road. Mm.
Thank you very much. It's a good point. Dernière question, maybe, and then we'll answer them all.
My name is Bijoy Padas. I'm a journalist from India's Northeast, Assam. My question, right, shall I repeat?
Okay. Yeah.
My question comes from Ms. Kamdar's interesting lineup of the headlines from India, and so your comment about the protection of minorities. I want to draw your attention to two human rights violations that's happening in India. A, the Northeast, where seven states are fighting for the right to self-determination, which is very violent, and there is a law that allows the military to shoot, to kill, to search, and arrest without a warrant, and that law is a British colonial law that still exists. And Iram Sharmila has been on a hunger strike since 2000, that's 13 years, to repeal it. Second is the India-Bangladesh border, which has become a killing field where there's indiscriminate killing. The government of India says these are India's internal affairs and no one should interfere. So my question to the panel, especially to the two of you, is that what should be the foreign policy stand? Do you agree that such human rights violations belong to the civil and internal domain of a country, or human rights violations doesn't matter the number or which border violations are violations? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Erwin?
Yeah, Erwin Kotler. I just have a short question for Mr. Petrov, but to invite also a comment from Carl Gershman on it, because he's been involved in these issues. Since the beginning, and this has been part of a theme here, since the beginning of the Syrian peaceful protest, which went on for 6 months while the international community was effectively a bystander to the atrocities, Russia, regrettably, has been not only an enabler of Syria, but have been complicit in that massive domestic repression. Now, I understand the historical geopolitical relationship of Russia and Syria and the like, but I can't understand this kind of complicity in these massive human rights violations. How do you explain it in terms of any of the lessons that you mentioned? Because I don't see this as being a matter of hostage of foreign policy to domestic policy. And what can we do to perhaps change Russia's behavior and have it be a responsible member of the international community?
Thank you very much. So why don't we go into reverse order? Would you like to take the question on Russia and Syria, and then we'll do the Indian question, and then we'll go to the other four after. Russia first.
Yeah. It's interesting that any time it goes about Syria, Russia is blamed and China is not mentioned, although they do occupy similar positions. In my view, what Russia is trying to prevent in Syria is less connected to Russia's geopolitical interests, which are not so important in this region, but it's connected with an idea not to create a precedent of international involvement in case of any troubles within the country, and here Russia is much more vulnerable. So this goes more about Russia than about Syria as such, in my view.
I would add that in talking with my Russian colleagues and friends recently, they have not forgotten the Libyan experience as well. I mean, Russia feels that they were perhaps cheated following the their agreement with the UN Security Council decision to have this operation in Libya. They never felt that it should go that far, and they're also afraid of a similar scenario repeating itself in Syria. India?
Well, thank you for that question. I actually had in my prepared remarks something to say about Iram Sharmila and her hunger strike. But I was pressed for time because I had too much to talk about. India is so complicated. And for those of you who don't know, this is a woman from northeastern India who has been on a hunger strike, which she herself very much situates in the tradition of Mahatma Gandhi and all the fasts that he undertook to protest injustice under British rule. She's being force-fed by the Indian government. The British Raj never force-fed Mahatma Gandhi. The Indian government is force-feeding her. They've been force-feeding her for years. The law to which the questioner referred is the Armed Forces Special Protection Act. Many, many civil society groups in India are begging the Indian government to do away with this act. It gives absolute immunity to any armed forces or security personnel from any crime that they may commit. And they commit crimes routinely. This has been well documented in Kashmir and in the Northeast and in the Maoist belt. Systematic raping, murdering, people disappeared. This happens in India's territory, and these people are completely immune because of this colonial era act. So this, but there are Indians themselves who are begging the government to get rid of this act. It's widely recognized as being very problematic. As for the Indian-Bangladeshi border, probably a lot of you don't know that the largest border fence is not the one that the Israelis have constructed to separate Palestinians from the Israelis, or the one that kind of started and sputtered out on the U.S. border with Mexico. It's on the India-Bangladeshi border. And India is very hard on this notion of a threat, of a wave of immigration from Bangladesh, something which with climate change is only likely to get worse. These violations occur. Now, India, and interestingly, if I could just connect this to the remarks about the right to protect and the United Nations, India was abstained on the Libya intervention, abstained earlier, and has not been keen on this right to protect thing because of these kinds of situations within its own borders. It does not want any outside power getting the notion that there might be any reason to intervene to protect Indian citizens. However, it co-sponsored, didn't it, the resolution to intervene in Mali with the French.
Yeah.
And I had the opportunity to have breakfast with Salman Khurshid in Berlin last month with some German leaders, and I asked him about that, and he was very cagey about it. And just 2 days later, India announced that it was also providing $100 million in reconstruction assistance in Mali. And, of course, I think this has everything to do with not the Rafale sale, perhaps, but France being a very important source of nuclear fuel and the uranium mines in Niger that Areva has. I mean, we were really in wheels within wheels and multi-dimensional geopolitics. But India, is acting as it projects its power increasingly in the world and as an emerging economy. You heard some of the numbers earlier. Feels that it has a right to project that power. It is increasingly able to do so, and it's not acting really any differently than a lot of other countries do. How we in the West, react to that. I think we've given India a pass on a lot of these things because we so desperately want to see it as a sort of good guy democracy contrasted with the bad guy China.
Thank you very much. Question on peacekeeping, how to get perhaps more support for peacekeeping operations around the world. You want to take this one?
Yes, sure. Well, first of all, it's nice to see that someone has faith in peacekeeping, and especially in UN peacekeeping, because the UN does a lot of the peacekeeping in the world, 16, 17 different missions, mostly in Africa. But sitting where I sit in New York and actually looking at what peacekeeping achieves, I have some a little bit more questions than you do. I think the key challenge, and I mentioned it in my presentation, is the continuum between peacekeeping and peace building. And we have not yet found the right formula, I think. It's the question of how you build institutions that are owned by people in the country, that make sense to them. And as the World Bank Development Report of last year said, it takes 15, 20 years to build institutions. But institutions are ultimately the only way to really protect people. It's, as I said earlier, you don't protect them by force. So you protect them by force just in the short term. But in the long term, it's only institutions that will make the difference. And it connects to the first questions on elections in fragile state. If you take the case of Kenya, the second election in Kenya that just happened in March of 2013 was much less violent than the one in 2007, which killed 1,500 people. And we're not out of the woods yet because the results of the elections are contested. But I think what makes the difference, or made the difference between the two elections, is the fact that there are now institutions in Kenya. There's a new constitution. There is a new electoral commission. There is a new chief justice, etc. That efforts have been made to change the rules and to make them more reliable, more solid in case of election dispute. Again, we're not out of the woods in Kenya, but it makes a difference, I think.
I would add that the world has changed an awful lot. I remember when, as a young diplomat, my own country, Canada, was involved in literally every significant peacekeeping operation in the world. At one stage, we were involved in 20 such operations. And today, I think that we're down the list. We're probably involved in one or two at the most. There's absolutely no will, no appetite for peacekeeping, certainly in Ottawa these days. It's an approach more targeted to real interest of Canada peacekeeping or humanitarian mission, perhaps, but only when there's a clear interest at stake. So this has changed a lot. Also, a factor that is has changed for all Western countries, budgets are not at all what they used to be. And just in Europe, it's very difficult to get the European countries to commit to peacekeeping operations as well. So there's a huge budgetary aspect to this as well.
Yeah, thanks. Let me start with that. I thought you were making an interesting point, but I just want to add a cautionary note about this very sharp distinction you were drawing between peacekeeping and the use of violence versus political means. It's not all one way or the other. You know, sometimes you can, without the use of violence or military forces to provide, that may be needed to provide stability in the situation, you can work politically to build political institutions. But obviously, in many situations in the world today, you have very fundamental security problems where you have some very bad elements out there that are engaged in violence. You know, George Orwell once wrote an essay about Gandhi, where he was sort of talking about the limitations of nonviolence. And he said, it's one thing to engage in nonviolence against the British Empire, where you have access to a free press and you can protest. But in the Soviet Union under Stalin, if you were a dissident, they would take you away in the middle of the night and put a bullet through your head, and that was it. And then, of course, you also have the example of Nazi Germany. There was no nonviolent way to oppose Nazi Germany. So let's recognize that, you know, we live in a world of different instruments. And sometimes you have to choose how much of one, how much of another, a different mix of these institutions. On Russia, Erwin, first, why? I think Russia has a stake in high oil prices. I don't think they really want stability in this world. Their survival of this regime depends upon oil prices staying high, and I think they have actually a stake in instability. And when you ask, how do we change Russia, you don't change Russia. I mean, maybe over time, I'll concede that it can be done. You're a little bit too optimistic with your short-term perspective, but over time, Russia may change. But right now, we have to bypass Russia, and you know, let's face it, there's a little bit of leadership that's needed from the United States in a country like Syria, which we haven't, I regret to say, have not provided in this situation. And, you know, we can blame Russia for it, but, you know, we carry some responsibility in not sort of saying maybe that's not the right way to go. It's not going to work for a lot of different reasons. The question on Afghanistan and the craziness, was it the word used, of entering into elections in a country like that. I mean, the problem we face in many countries in the world today is that, you know, you need some kind of a legitimate domestic authority unless you want to, you know, replace it with an international protectorate in the Congo, for example, which gets terribly expensive and it's very difficult. But you need some legitimate domestic authority, as difficult as that is, and it's hard to think of how that can be done without elections, and they can be abused. That may be a way of getting into a concluding point about just the, we have to take a long-term view of the work that we're in. Two countries that have been mentioned in this discussion, Afghanistan and Russia, just think of them and think of their history. Think of what Afghanistan has been through since 1978, 1979, with the Soviet invasion, the Civil War, the Taliban. This is a country that was torn apart. How do you rebuild after that? That is going to take a very, very long time. And Russia, the Soviet Union, the end of the empire, the collapse of totalitarianism, the grotesque, you know, killing that took place under Stalin, the entire intelligentsia, millions of people killed in the 30s and the 40s. This was a devastated country, aside from being a bankrupt country economically because of the inefficiencies of the totalitarian system. It's going to take a very, very long time. I mean, you don't have any kind of a strong democratic tradition in Russia. Going back to the Tsars, you had a very brief period between 1864 and the First World War, but there was very little there. And we just have to take a very, very long-term perspective on these things and not give up. I mean, we have to stay engaged in various ways. And there are, the fact that there are local forces in Russia that are conducting this fight, or in Afghanistan, they need help. And we should, at the very least, provide help to those local forces, to let them know that they're not alone. I think, you know, the situation is actually much better in Russia today than it was during Soviet times, even though it's moving backward rather drastically under Putin. And we have to do what we can to try to, you know, Putin is cracking down now because he's trying to reverse the gains that were made, you know, in from December 2011 through the spring. He's trying to reverse that. And we have to push back and, you know, help the democratic forces inside the country try to reverse the momentum in that country.
Thank you very much. We will stop here because I've already passed our time. So a good round of applause for our speakers, please. We have a